You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives, where all we do is win, guys. I'm Chadwick Matlin, editor at 538. Far to my right, Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
And closer to my right, Neil Payne,
hey,
sports
Chad.
Writer at 538. Guys, we're testing out video. So now when I say far to the right,
that means something.
It means
people.
Something. It may
They'll
mean something.
See.
Listeners, coming soon. Perhaps you can see our sterling mugs. On today's show, we're going to talk about NBA Conference Finals, and Sir Charles Barkley will make an appearance in voice form, not quite in the studio yet. That's coming, hopefully, you know, within a year or so. We'll also talk about NHL playoffs. I hear there's a whole other playoff going on in the hockey that we haven't talked about at all. Nate Silver will be in the house, in the studio, not just in voice.
On video.
Our number one hockey fan.
That's right. And then we haven't tortured Kate for a while about baseball. So we're going to bring back baseball, but though, Kate, sounds like you're excited to talk about this baseball segment about StatCast.
I am. I have some thoughts. Good. And then I'll work the Mets into it, too, I'm sure.
As will I. Okay. That's our role here.
I'm both sandwiched between two Mets fans here.
As a Phillies fan should be.
Right.
Okay. But first, before we get into the NBA, I wanted to give a shout-out to Tariq Laskar, who sent us a great hot take that emerged in the wild. And we're always looking for new hot takes that we can put in our theme song. We would have totally put this one in if it weren't a tweet. Because the BBC did tweet, could at Andy Murray be the new King of Clay? He's attempting 3 titles in 2 weeks. And at this point, Murray had won 2 tournaments on clay. And so because he was trying to get a third, they were like, oh, maybe he's supplanted Nadal as the King of Clay. And rather incredibly, Andy Murray wrote back at BBC Sport, ha 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 ha, exclamation point, no, which I loved. And so, listeners, keep sending us hot takes to put in the theme song. You can send it to contact@538.com or any of our Twitter handles, and we'll be sure to see if it merits the Hall of Fame treatment at the top of the show. Okay, basketball. The NBA brackets are awfully chalky this year. We have 2 conference finals, 1 and 2 seed. The Hawks, the Cavs, the Warriors, the Rockets. But the Rockets are only there thanks to an epic Clippers collapse. Despite being up by 13 at the start of the fourth quarter, 19 at one point in the third quarter, the Clippers choked away the lead and barely were competitive in Game 7, it seemed to me. Here's the Daily News' Frank Isola with our first take, talking about the Clips collapse on ESPN Radio.
You're not going to find a better guy than Doc Rivers, and for people in the media, he's very accessible. But come on now, if Vinny Del Negro had lost that Game 6, what if Scott Brooks had lost that kind of Game 6? I mean, they'd be getting eviscerated by people. That's Europe 19 with 14 and a half minutes to go. And basically, you lost to Josh Smith and Corey Brewer.
So there seemed to be 2 things going on in that clip. One was the magnitude of the loss, that how unexpected it was in Game 6, and then obviously the losing the series in general. And then whether Rivers gets a pass compared to other coaches. So let's take one at a time. Did the Clippers really have this thing in the bag? And should we be as shocked that they let it go like they did?
Well, you mentioned it yourself. According to the win probability metric, specifically the one at unpredictable.com, they had a 99.1% chance of winning late in the third quarter of Game 6 before everything fell off. That's a lot to lose in a little over 60 minutes of actual game time. They lost almost 100% chance of winning the series.
Yeah, and I think the one thing that stuck out to me was that if they were going to collapse at some point during a game, it would be at the exact time when you start to see that number go down, because that's when, in most NBA rotations, you put in your second team. And that's been and has been the big glaring hole for the Clippers, is they get almost no scoring from their bench aside from Jamal Crawford. And certainly when he's hot, he can almost account for a strong bench. Like he equals like one or two players, but when he's not playing well, and then when you know Austin Rivers isn't playing well, their bench is nothing. And so that to me was always going to be their Achilles heel in terms of their rotation and when those guys came in. And then on the other side was the Rockets that does have a strong bench now that they picked up Josh Smith and Brewer. So
Joni.
Yeah, exactly. So this was an epic, shocking collapse because I know when in talking about this series all along, you know, you have the thought in your head and the narrative that because they had beaten the Clippers in that game seven with a shot, the likes of which we hadn't seen from Chris Paul, and it was like this Clippers team has gone away from the narrative that they're going to somehow slip up and they're new and they're different and they've got this soul, and then all of a sudden, you know, in that fourth quarter, end of third, you see that collapse.
And they dominated at points during the series, too. I think that was another thing that was sort of made it even more surprising is that, you know, they were blowing out Houston in game three, in game four, and it looked like they were on track to win in game six. And so when you think about it, that 99.1% chance that we mentioned earlier, that has the pregame Vegas odds also baked into it. So we're not just talking about, like, if you plop down two teams that were evenly matched and kind of gave them that advantage. But theoretically, the Clippers had an even higher chance of winning because talent-wise, a lot of the leading indicators and even the betting markets thought that they were a lot better.
So let me ask you real quick about the blowouts, and then I want to get to Rivers. Do blowouts suggest something? If you're up by a lot, if you're up by 19, is that suggestive of your talent the way that if you won by 19 might be? Does that make sense?
Being up at any point.
Because you just said, yeah, that they looked really dominant, but in some of the games they looked dominant, they lost the lead or got really tight at the end. So should we be judging their dominance based on what happens when the buzzer goes off or at some point during the game?
That's an interesting question because there have been studies that sort of give evidence in both directions. For instance, in college football, there's a metric that our former colleague Dean Oliver made, which was just took the average win probability of a team throughout the game. So if you were up, you know, for the majority of the game and then collapsed at the very end, you would score really well in this metric. And they sort of tried to see if that was more predictive than the score at the end of the game. And turns out that it actually wasn't, that the score at the final gun is more predictive than whether you were up for the majority of the game but then blew the lead at the end. But then there's also a lot of evidence in the NBA, especially that teams play, like when they have a big lead, they let up, and it's as much as 20% of what you would expect from them if they had just kept playing hard the entire game. They'll lose that, and that even takes into account whether or not they take their, you know, best players off the court and then put in a bunch of scrubs. Even if you leave the best players on the court, they will, it must be psychological, they'll just, you know, sort of let up and let the other team back into the game, and it's sort of the way basketball works. Like, you're never as good as you look when you have a huge run, and you're never as bad as you look when the other team does.
And I know fans of hockey and people who have played hockey, and I know we'll talk hockey later, but say that the worst lead you can have is a 2-0 lead. And obviously the whole human nature coming in that, like, oh, we have a cushion, but then once you give up, if you give up that one goal, all of a sudden it's a one-goal game, then all of a sudden the pressure has shifted to you. And I think that has always happened, at least when I was covering the NBA, in these series too, because you could see you're up 3-1 if you're the Clippers, and no matter what you tell yourself, no matter what you tell the media, you think we have 3 cracks at this. And it's human nature to, on some level, not be as focused or as locked in the same way you're saying when you get a big lead in the game, not just in a series but in a game. All those things play into what we see from players in like a game five.
Which is why you see the coaches still screaming and lending this false
urgency. Right, they're trying to bridge that gap almost.
And the interesting thing is that the more predictive of the metrics in basketball is when you adjust for that and you actually give the team credit for what they would be or what they had before they started slacking off, which does tend to suggest that leading huge on a team matters even if you don't finish the deal or if you let up.
We can get to this when we talk about the Rangers in hockey because they've played so many one-goal games. But so to Rivers and to the Usola's other point in the take that we played, he was arguing that Rivers essentially gets a pass because he's friendly. And I don't want to necessarily critique the media here because I'm not sure we have the beat reporters in. I mean, although Kate, you were a beat reporter, yeah. So maybe you could tell us about whether a good coach or a friendly coach uh-huh. does matter. So let's start there, and then I'll get to the rest.
No, that absolutely matters. I don't know how many times I have walked away from a Doc Rivers specific availability, like a pregame availability when the Sixers would play the Celtics, when he coached the Celtics, and the crowd around him would be bigger than usual, and the Boston guys would often be like, I don't ever want to be in a position to get him fired, right? To write a column saying he needs to be fired because he's too good of a guy and he's too good with the media. And that plays into people's minds. I know even in Philly, when you had like GMs or coaches who were friendly or they lived in the community, and that would be a conversation in the press room, was like, you know, I would write a column like going hard on the Sixers' choices, but at the end of the day, I'm not going to write the column saying he should be fired.
Because you saw him at Sam Hinkie at the farmer's market or something.
Whoever the previous GMs had been, or right. Sam Hinkie, or your kids are in the same right. classes together. I mean, those things
human psychology
matter.
Enter in,
yeah. It matters much more than maybe everyday fans think it might.
And it's probably also the value of giving you good quotes and giving you things to work with. He's an entertaining guy.
Yeah, I mean, you do build relationships with people, and sometimes it can feel like, well, then if you're writing in the paper about flaws and decisions that should be made, that almost feels like you're stabbing somebody in the back, which is why you try and keep that distance.
So let's get to Doc Rivers as a coach, though. From the stats perspective, he won a championship with Boston. I wonder how much leeway that gives him when he loses multiple playoff series in a row, both with Boston and with the Clippers. Do we have a sense for his quality as a coach? And do we have a sense for what should be the overarching reputation of a coach or of a player? If you win a championship, should that crowd out your failure to get back there, or if you lose when you shouldn't on the way?
To the extent that we can measure coaching, which is not really all that well right now, but you can look at things like how do the players play when Rivers is coaching them versus how they play with other coaches. And he comes out looking good, but not one of the best coaches, according to those. But I think also, you're right, there's this championship halo. And the list of coaches who have won NBA championships it's kind of an exclusive club, just because so few different franchises tend to win championships. And they're all sort of clustered in these dynasties, these groups of two and three championships in a row Yeah, I think that there is this halo effect to it, and it's kind of weird because we like to have it both ways, right? We like to talk about how the players are all that matter in the NBA and that it's all about the star power, and you can't win without a superstar is another thing that we've heard a lot, especially in recent years. And yet at the same time, we also want to give credit to the championship-winning coaches as having some extra something that the coaches that don't win the championships don't have.
And I think another thing that has helped Rivers in the story we tell about him at the Clippers is that before he got there, they had performed poorly mm-hmm. in the postseason, despite having a talent level that should have suggested a better performance in the postseason. And that had happened repeatedly. So I think it's going to take even longer for us to think that the burden for that failure should be shifted to Doc Rivers and not some sort of like preternatural issue with the Los Angeles Clippers, because to this point it's almost been, it's going to take Doc Rivers the time to turn around that quote unquote narrative in Los Angeles. I think what's hurting him here in terms of like who we're going to blame is that he's also responsible for player personnel for this team. And so when we talked earlier about the collapse in game six because they have no bench, like We can't say, well, the general manager didn't get him the players he wanted.
So let's move on to the teams that are still in the playoffs, as they deserve some time as well. So the Warriors and the Rockets. The Warriors have beat the Rockets all four times that they played in the regular season. Neil, you ran the numbers. What chance did your model give them to actually beat did your model give the Warriors to beat the Rockets?
So we said that the Warriors had a 91% chance of beating the Rockets, and the Warriors have been off the charts by the stats all postseason long and really all season long. We also said that there was an even higher percentage chance that they would win over Memphis in the previous round. And at one point, they were down 2-1 even in that series. So it doesn't mean that you have no chance whatsoever against the Warriors, certainly, but after running the most recent numbers, you know, they still seem to be the team to beat.
And so in the write-ups that I've read, and Kate, I'm curious for your thoughts, it seems as though people have keyed in on the Rockets' defense as having no chance against the Warriors. And funny enough, one of the hot takes in our intro is from Charles Barkley, and now it's thought of as an anti-analytics take. But originally it started as a screed against the Rockets' defense. So let's listen to that real quick.
I have a feeling Daryl wasn't very kind of you describing Houston as a bad defensive team. In fact, you said worst in the league defensive team.
A lot of teams that's going to make the playoffs, they're awful defensively.
But they're, if you look at the metrics on the thing, they're like number five in the league defensively.
They're not. Just because you got good stats doesn't mean you're a good team defensively. They're not a good defensive team. They gave up 118 points. No good team gives up 118 points. I'm not worried about Daryl Morey. He's one of those idiots who believe in analytics. He went out and got James Harden and got Dwight Howard and going to tell me that's analytics. Then he went out and got Trevor Ariza. But then he went out and got Josh Smith. The NBA is about talent. All these guys who run these organizations who talk about analytics, they have one thing in common. They're a bunch of guys who ain't never played the game, and they never got the girls in high school, and they just want to get in the game.
So, Kate, when you watch the Rockets, and we'll get to the numbers in a second, when you watch the Rockets, what do you see from a defensive standpoint? Are they as bad as Barkley makes them out to be?
No, I mean, they're not. And one, I thank you so much for editing that hot take to not include the girls' high school line. You didn't want to have to hear that right. Every time we launched this. So I didn't know that he had said that particular part. They're not as bad. I think, in a way, Barkley's being a little bit lazy in that assessment of Houston because we have this idea of Harden as being the worst defender ever and lazy. And that's not true anymore. I think for this series in particular, and Zach Lowe at Grantland has a great piece that sort of breaks down everything tenfold in every position in every matchup on this. But I think for me, what I'm going to be trying to figure out is how Houston is going to manage Curry on the perimeter. And also who Harden is going to guard, right? So, because if he's guarding Klay Thompson, that's going to be pretty tough for him to chase Klay around and also be as effective as he needs to be on offense. But at the same time, if he's guarding somebody else, and Zach points this out, he's going to have to, as he's running back on defense, like crisscross the court to pick up whoever the other guy is. So the Rockets, though, are not as bad defensively as from the eye test.
Right. Yeah. It went back to what Ernie Johnson said in that clip, which was sort of suggesting that Barkley was only looking at points per game, but the analytics emphasized that you should look at things on a per possession basis, and Houston had the second fastest pace of any team during the regular season. So defensively, they were a top 10 defensive team in terms of points per possession allowed during the season. And, Barkley probably wouldn't argue with that. He said in the clip that, it doesn't matter that, you know, they can't get stops when they need the stops. But if you look at those last few games of that Clippers series, Clippers were the top offensive team in terms of efficiency during the regular season. And they held them in two consecutive games well below what their regular season average was, including in the final game, a closeout game, they held them to 97 points per 100 possessions. This was a team that scored 112 points per 100 possessions during the season. So if anything, their defense carried them. And when we're talking about this matchup against the Warriors, the difference between the two teams is less about offense, or it's less about the two differences in, you know, whether or not Houston can keep up and shut down Golden State's offense. It's about whether or not Houston actually can play offensively and execute against a Warriors team, which is actually very good defensively. So that would be the matchup that sort of more will determine who wins this series than the matchup of Houston's D against Golden State's offense.
That's interesting. And so it brought up too, and Kate, you mentioned that Zach Lowe piece. One of the interesting things that I found in it was that they were saying that the Warriors' defense is so good on the perimeter, with Iguodala so long and able to run off ball screens and whatever else. And interior, you have Bogut and Barnes clogging the paint. And so perhaps what Harden and the rest of the Rockets' strategy would be to pull up and take mid-range jumpers rather than penetrate all the way in. And what's so interesting is that like is analytics eating its own tail a little bit, which is that the Rockets are built to shoot threes or drive to the basket. Mm-hmm. But now we're saying there's a defense that could stop them from doing both of those things. And so then is the analytics thing to do to defy analytics in the first place?
Yeah, that part is baffling to try and work out. But I don't think, although the analytics would suggest that Golden State is quote-unquote weakest if Harden is going to get to that mid-range area and not go all the way to the rim for reasons you pointed out, I just can't see Houston trying to exploit that specifically because of the way it's always played.
And it causes other problems if you change your strategy all of a sudden to do mid-ranges.
Oh, I mean, it's so hard as an athlete to be playing one way for so long and then thinking, well, the data shows this would be better. Well, that doesn't matter because of the account of emotional toll it's going to take to completely change up what you've been doing all year long.
So let's talk about the Hawks and Cavs, which seems to be sort of the run to the litter as far as these playoff series go. Neil, you've been looking into the composition of those two teams, and we should disclose as ever that you used to work for the Hawks, no longer. Now you're all ours. But you know, it seems as though the teams were constructed differently, and especially now after injuries, the distribution of talent is quite different.
Yeah, the Hawks are more of a team that spreads out their value across many different players. We have this metric, wins above replacement, which just shows how much value a player added, basically. And in the playoffs so far, the Hawks have five guys who have added more than a half a win above replacement, whereas when it comes to the Cavs, they only have three guys that have done that. So it really gives you a sense of the way that the two teams are composed, and the idea that the Cavs are LeBron first, and you know Irving and Shumpert has played a lot better, but in total it's a bunch of role players around LeBron James, especially with Kevin Love's absence. That sort of rings true according to the stats, whereas the Hawks don't really have one guy that you can key in on like a LeBron and say, well, we can't let this guy beat us, because they have many guys like that. But it probably won't matter because the Cavs and LeBron, by extension, are just better than the Hawks at the end of the day, especially the way the Hawks have looked in the first two rounds.
Atlanta, when you watch them in the regular season against Cleveland, right, they were the only team to beat them three times. And they did so by really blitzing the pick and rolls. And I think right now what's going to be interesting for me is that, one, Cleveland's counter to those pick and rolls would be to penetrate and open up lanes and kick to Kevin Love. Okay, but he's not there. So you would think advantage Atlanta, because the Cavs don't have that big guy who can spread the floor. But at the same time, because of Love's injury, they've put LeBron at the four and gone with a small lineup that has just been completely dominant according to like stats, that lineup with Amon Shumpert and Kyrie and LeBron at the four, and then whether it's Thompson or Mozgov at the five. So, and I don't think Atlanta wants to see that lineup either. But I'm curious, Neil, if you know whether it's my gut instinct to completely dismiss whatever Atlanta has done against the Cavs in the regular season. Is that what we want to do?
So my colleague Ben Morris, about a year ago, he did this with regard to the Heat versus Nets series, that ultimately the Heat did very well against the Nets in the playoffs, but during the regular season, the Nets had given some trouble to the Heat, and he looked at all cases where similar things, just even like this Atlanta versus Cleveland series, where one team sort of the overall results between the one team and the rest of the league seemed to suggest that the favorite is heavily favored, but then there was this weird matchup thing when they played during the regular season, and he found that that did matter. It wasn't anywhere near enough to cover a big advantage, but at the margins that it could matter, like if a team, you know, the matchup mattered if a team was favored by only 1 point, but they had done very poorly against the team that they were playing during the regular season. The problem here is that Cleveland seems to be favored by more than would be affected by this particular matchup aspect.
So let's leave it there for now and bring in a message from our sponsor while the immortal Nate Silver comes into the studio and gets set for our hockey segment. Our sponsor this week is SeatGeek, the smartest way for fans to save money on sports tickets. You know the feeling, you're in the stadium, you're sitting there looking at all the other people who are there, and you're wondering how much did they pay for their tickets. It's the kind of doubt that can gnaw at somebody. They have what is essentially the same seat as you do, but they may have gotten it for much less money. or maybe more money and you want to feel superior to them. SeatGeek can help with that. It harnesses all sorts of data to give you a range of ticket prices, aggregating tickets from every major ticket site online and taking into account historical ticket prices, the day of the week, who the opponent is, etc. This week, you can use promo code TAKEDOWN on the SeatGeek app and get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do is download the app, enter the promo code before you buy your tickets, and SeatGeek will send you $20 once you've made your first purchase. That's promo code TAKEDOWN. The SeatGeek app is your ticket to sports this spring. So, on to hockey. No one in the 538 office is following it as intently as our chief hockey writer, Nate Silver.
Temporarily editor-in-chief / temporary interim chief hockey writer.
Exactly. Yeah. And you don't have to tell us which one you prefer or which title you prefer. So we thought we'd bring you on, Nate, to talk about what's what. What is it about hockey that so appeals to you, Nate?
So part of it is growing up in Michigan, which is where I guess we call ourselves like the 11th province. There are 10 provinces, right?
Canada, we're kind of
surrounded by Canada in all directions. I grew up watching a lot of college hockey, Michigan State games every weekend. So, you know, in a few parts of the country, Michigan, Minnesota, some parts of the Northeast, hockey is one of the big four sports.
And so I don't think we talked about hockey really, aside from that, when we brought Mike Lopez on a few weeks ago to talk about it. Are you guys hockey people, Kate and Neil? Are you watching the playoffs?
I am watching the Rangers this year for the first time. The last time I watched hockey closely was when I lived in Colorado and the Avalanche won the Stanley Cup. I watched every game of that postseason.
With the immortal Patrick Waugh.
Exactly.
That's right.
Nate's favorite goaltender ever.
We're going to get there. Yep. Don't jump ahead.
But yeah, and part of it is I live like literally right across the block from Madison Square Garden. So my neighborhood, it's like the World Cup or something for the Rangers. I mean, it's like you're surrounded by Rangers paraphernalia and propaganda, and you're very, very aware of what's going on.
Okay, so let's talk about the Rangers. Yeah. How many games this playoffs have you been to see them?
I've been to about half the games. I went down to Washington, actually.
Commuting for the Rangers.
It's really fun to actually go to the other team's stadium and have your team win and be a total yahoo in the process. That's, like, really awesome, especially when it's, like, Washington, which is not my favorite city.
So they've had a pretty nail-biting tournament. At one point, they had played in 14 straight playoff games that were decided by one goal, and that goes back to the last playoffs, right?
Yeah, so until Monday night, every game they had played in the playoffs was a one-goal game, as were the last two games in the Stanley Cup final last year. So the odds against that, in theory, are about 32,000-1 against to have a streak of 15, however many it was, in a row.
And so here's Henrik Lundqvist, their goalie, talking about what that is like to play that many close games in a row.
I think we all understand that every play matters throughout the game because we're that close every game. To keep your focus throughout the game is key, and I think we also have confidence in our group when it comes down to it.
So give that number again, Nate. How rare is it to play that many one-goal games?
So in the dead puck era, it depends on how you date that, but the really low scoring period we've been in for 15 years or so, about half of playoff games are decided by one goal. So basically it's flipping a coin every time. If the probabilities are independent, we can get into advanced probability theory if you like. But it was a weird streak. I mean, there was one game where the Rangers, again, they lost to the Penguins. They scored like a junk time goal with 4 seconds left to make it a one-goal loss instead of a two-goal loss. In game one against Tampa, they had all these opportunities to score an empty net goal, and they didn't, right? So it was a weird type of streak. And I don't think it was anything deliberate they were trying to do exactly. But
do you think there's something about the New York Rangers as they're constructed that led to that streak, or was it completely random in your mind?
Well, what's weird is they're a pretty well-balanced team, really, right? I mean, they're one of the better defensive teams, but also one of the better offensive teams in hockey, at least this season. You know, I'm trying to think about maybe the way they play or fail to play well on the power play, if there's something else about it. But the thing is, like, look, you have a lot of opportunities for weird things to happen in sports, right? You can take any sequence of 15 games in a row by an NHL team, you know. And if we had, for example, 7 straight Rangers games that were decided 3-1, we'd say that's pretty weird, but what were the odds of that, right? So, you know, this is more in the range of something that's just kind of a fun, quirky statistical thing than necessarily something that means something.
But less quirky is what you mentioned, which is how distributed they are. You wrote a piece that said that in the last 50 years, for the best team in the league, that's the President's Trophy, right? They were the most distributed of any team that was the best in the league. So there is something about that their construction is seems to be purposeful, that, that they have a sort of a more plateaued distribution.
So they're a really deep team, and that probably helps if you're playing a lot of high-intensity minutes in games that go into overtime. The one place where it hurts them, and we saw this a little bit, they scored two power play goals last night, but in a game like Monday night where you had a lot of penalties called, you know, they were 20th in the league on the power play because they don't have that offensive star talent. They have a lot of good players, but they don't gain as much on the power play as almost any other team in the league.
And Neil, you were looking at their Corsi rating, and this is where we stop the podcast, slow down, and explain to listeners what Corsi is, as I have asked you to do to me, Neil, at least once a month over the 15 months that we've known each other. So the Rangers aren't good at Corsi, and Corsi is what?
So Corsi is the proportion of shots that are directed at the net, so they don't have to go in. They don't even have to be stopped by the goalie. They just have to sort of be in the direction of the net. And there's another variety called Fenwick, if you really want to get in the weeds, that I believe does not include block shots. One does and one doesn't, and those two, that's the only difference between the two. But it's the proportion that you did out of all the ones that took place on the ice by both teams. But really, it's just a proxy for who had possession and how much you had possession. And a lot of the advanced stats in hockey, especially over the last decade or so, have found that it's really important to have possession of the puck. And it's more so than even if you include like whether you scored when you had possession of it or if your shots were going in, just because the scoring is kind of random. Like unless you have a huge sample of shots, these things tend to regress to the mean. Is that right?
So now, well, see, now I'm going to sound like a sophomoric or junior, but you know, I'm going to push back on that a little bit, which is the Rangers, if you put it in basketball terms, they're not a good half-court team. Their power play is not that good. They're fantastic to watch in transition. So you think of these games as being low scoring, but they skate really, really well, right? They create opportunities in transition. And so, you know, they're not a team that has to possess the puck necessarily. It's like our soccer. It's like a Uruguay or something, a team that counterattacks a lot. Right.
It's sort of getting higher quality chances per out of all of your chances. The higher proportion is
higher quality chances, and they can kind of lull teams into giving them opportunities to have a opportunity on transition, for instance, right? Where in the you know, if they're in their offensive zone, or the team's offensive zone, their offensive zone, you know, they're really not all that good. They're a mediocre at best kind of power play team.
Right, and that plays into the Corsi that we talked about also, because they finished around the middle of the pack of NHL teams, but they had the best record in hockey, so they were doing things. The only way that happens, having the best record despite the mediocre Corsi, is you're either really good at goaltending, which we know that they were because they had not one but two of the best goalies in the league, and they also, you know, shot at a high percentage or a higher than average percentage.
Yeah, or you can get lucky too, but you know, I do think we need to remember when looking at advanced hockey stats that these stats are really quite primitive, right? They're better than nothing, but you know, we're kind of a decade beyond what we have in basketball or baseball.
Behind what we have,
for example. Yeah, so yeah. I tend to be skeptical when advanced stats say, well, the Rangers aren't that good, and you've kind of seen the evidence of it for 2 years now, basically, right? Then I think there is room to be skeptical about
that. So I want to talk about goaltending, because every year I feel like I memorize a goaltender's name that I'd never heard of before, and I think can pronounce Jean-Sebastien Giguère.
Right? It's a spell checking nightmare to file those articles.
Who had such a run for the Ducks, whenever that was, 10 years ago or
2003?
So.
2003?
Look at that, off the top of Neil's head. But this year it doesn't seem like we have that breakout goaltender, and Nate, you looked into the history of playoff goaltending in the NHL and handed out something that you dubbed the WAH Awards, which you basically named to torture podcast panelists.
It's a really hard name to say.
WAH Awards. The awards. And what do you find about this year or about years past and why the goaltenders this year aren't as good?
Well, part of it is in the Rangers Cap series, especially through the first five games, you had the spectacular goaltending battle between Lundqvist and Holtby. And seeing where that ranked, it wound up being, I think, ninth all-time by some advanced stat that we devised, which is kind of a fun stat, though. It looks at win probability added for goaltenders. But, you know, it is fun to see lists like this that just remind you of some great hockey history, like when Dominik Hasek stopped 70 shots in a four-overtime shutout against the Devils in 1994, for example.
So these are like game scores for pitchers, but for goaltenders a little bit.
Yeah, and there's some fun stuff it would do. Like, for example, Henrik Lundqvist was not very good in game two, giving up 6 goals. But beyond a certain point, if you've given up 4 goals in today's NHL playoffs, even 3, you're probably going to lose.
Just let the rest in.
Just
right?
let the rest in beyond a certain point. This is one of the interesting things, by the way, about being someone who is aware that there is a lot of luck in hockey and having watched kind of almost every Ranger playoff game. So you can kind of see your head churning and being like, oh, I want to build a narrative about this, right? Like, oh, it was such a natural spot for a letdown game, right? And they were really sloppy. And then still, though, they did take more shots, right? A couple of the goals, gave up a goal, a 3-on-5 goal, which was kind of amazing to watch. But, you know, I mean, how much of it is luck versus not? If those teams kind of replayed that game 1,000 times, how often would the Rangers have won? I'm not quite sure. But it is fun to build the narratives. It was always a letdown game. They were exhausted. You know, it was a choppy style of play that does not play to their up-and-down style, the Rangers.
That's the tension anytime you're a fan. You're trying to make sense of, like, what feels like a very emotional guttural thing.
Of course it is, yeah. But usually,
that maybe temper you.
But usually, since I'm trying to do so many things at once, right, I'll kind of float about and see a lot of games, or not a lot of games for any one team, right? For some reason, every now and then, it happened with me. It's when I lived in the neighborhood. I lived in Wrigleyville in 2003 and kind of became enamored with that year's Cubs, right? But every now and then, it's fun to kind of get emotionally and intellectually invested in one team during a fun year.
So, real quick, because we're running long on time, if you had to offer listeners something about that other series that's happening on the other side of the country between Anaheim and Chicago, what would you say to look for?
Well, the Ducks are an interesting case, too, and I need to study them more because they actually had, I think, the best record in the Western Conference, but they only outscored their opponents by 10 goals.
Their Corsi also was mediocre, right?
Right, yeah. It was like 3 slots ahead of the Rangers, I think.
And they've probably been the best team in the NHL playoffs so far. They've not played a particularly tough schedule exactly. But I don't know. I mean, you know, look, they're ahead by 1 game. I'm not going to make a bolder prediction than say they're probably favored now. But Chicago was a fun team to watch play, and watching Chicago and New York match up in the finals would be a heck of an NHL final. Chicago and New York actually share very few times when they've played in like a major sport final. You get to go back to like the 1962 NFL championship. Never happened in the Super Bowl, for example. Not since World War II or so in baseball. You had some Cubs-Yankees way long ago. But that'd be fun.
Okay, Nate, thanks for coming in. Listeners, you can read all of this guy Nate Silver's hockey coverage on a little blog called 538.com. It's his personal blog. Hopefully ESPN might take notice at some point and do something with it. Nate, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Chad.
So on to baseball and StatCast.
StatCast!
Woo! Yay! So it's a new technology that tracks where the baseball is, where the players are, and maybe where the fans are. Who knows if it wants to get a little NSA. It's been a boon for broadcasters who have more stats to use and different kinds of stats to use. Things like route efficiency, exit velocity off the bat, of the ball off the bat, spin rate of a pitch coming in to home plate. All those things have sort of entered the lexicon, at least for baseball obsessives who have been watching too many MLB.com highlights. And so here are some guys on the MLB Network breaking down the spin rate of Koji Uehara and Garrett Richards' pitches so you can get a sense for what StatCast sounds like in a broadcast.
And it is not so much the velocity that is creating swings and misses. It is the spin rate. He is among the leaders of all of his pitches in having high spin rate. So what that is an outstanding evaluative tool. You look at a guy that throws in the mid-90s, and you may see him that he's getting hit all over the ballpark, but a guy like Garrett Richards, who has that incredible high spin rate, creates movement and really deception to the hitter.
You know, you guys have incredible high spin rates. I've always thought that.
I've always thought that. Yeah.
And I've always been deceptive to the hitters also.
So this thing about StatCast brings up something that we talked about before and that Nate talked about a few weeks ago with Steve Kettman, the guy who had written that New York Times op-ed about whether stats were ruining baseball. Do we need more stats in baseball? Do you guys feel like this was a value add the more you read and watched?
I mean, my initial thought was that basically we're like mapping these players until they become video game characters, like equipped with like a power level for each thing that they do.
And a lot of the stuff does resemble the graphics that you see in video games, that you saw those in the games before you saw them on television.
Yeah, like 10 years ago, you could be in like NBA Jam, you know, you could be like, oh, so-and-so has a 42% at this skill, and then you could
with
see all the skills.
With a trailing fire path that they're running.
Exactly, and they could, you know, jump above the rim to dunk in certain video games. But yeah, but it, in a way, it's almost like these stats are mirroring that and giving you that same viewpoint of the players. So I was kind of skeptical of that, like, oh, let us be pure. But then when I looked into a couple of the added insight that they could provide, like, it was interesting to me. Like, one of them that I would find interesting is if it's able to map where a runner is leading off of the base, right? Because it supposedly
it can.
And of course, it's going to be able to tell you the velocity of a pitch on an attempted stolen base, the catcher's rate of popping up and throwing. But I would love to know successful stolen bases, what the average lead is. You know, I mean, that would be fascinating to me. And I'm assuming fascinating to players to be like, well, you know, if you're X feet away from the base, you have this probability of being, you know, of being called safe versus...
Or where the break-even is, where you're going to get picked off or something instead of being able to steal.
That's all fascinating stuff. And I know Neil will have something to say about Chase Utley and, you know, the velocity at which he hits the ball versus how successful he's been this season. That was fascinating to me as well. So a lot of this stuff, when I started reading about it, I can see the added value and also some of the drawbacks as well.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, this is the culmination of what people thought was the ideal of sabermetrics when they first, you know, right after Moneyball came out, there was this perceived divide between scouting and metrics. But a lot of people who are the more reasoned voices were saying, no, 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 they can coexist and they might even converge into becoming the same thing. And in a lot of ways, I think this is a bit of a realization of that dream, because you're getting data on things that used to be sort of scout hunches or things that scouts used to be their province to measure. But in a good way, you can actually prove that certain things, but then it's up to the scouts and the people who analyze this data. And there's hordes of data analysts from prestigious schools who have joined baseball front offices too in the last decade. These guys have to also interpret it and know what to do with it, and it's a lot of data. So it's this, we talk about big data as sort of this catchphrase, this watchword. This really is big data. It's taking, you know, ever so many snapshots of where players are or where the ball is per second, you know, throughout a game, and it's using Doppler radar, as part of it, in addition to these camera tracking things. So it's amazing, and being able to unlock the secrets of this voluminous, you know, data that we've added into the game only recently is going to be a big edge for whichever team figures it out.
I mean, this seems like a perfect dovetail of the data you can accumulate and then also applying human knowledge to it. Like, the one anecdote that I read was about, you know, two outfielders making great plays to a hit baseball, and the data saying, well, who took the faster route to the ball, and then labeling that the more efficient catch and the more efficient outfielder. But then any baseball analyst would tell you the difference of like a ball hit right at you and taking an angle where you go back first and then you come in for a ball, and how that can be successful for outfielders. And so the data itself wasn't going to give you the full picture of the play, but it certainly gave you a very good insight into an outfielder's first step, an outfielder that does take direct lines, but also that human ability to also say, well, you don't always want a direct line, right? Certain, if it's hit into the pocket, you want to take that looping angle to give yourself more of a chance to the ball. So I love the ability of numbers, but also seeing where the human interpretation of them was really valuable.
So I want to talk about Chase Utley,
if only please.
To torture Neil, but also to say that our colleague Rob Arthur at 538 wrote a super interesting piece about exit velocity, and this is one of the new hit FX, is what it's called, stats that's part of StatCast. How fast the ball is moving off of the bat when hitters make contact. And so he looked at exit velocity and how it correlated to OPS, so to slugging plus on-base percentage, and he found that there was a real correlation. And I think, I don't have the stat right in front of me, but I think every extra mile per hour that the ball left the bat was worth like 18 extra points of OPS. And that's really, that's real and considerable. And then what he did was looked at thus far in the season who is over, who's exceeding their expected performance based on the exit velocity that they're hitting the ball with, and who's underperforming. And he dubbed Chase Utley the unluckiest man in baseball.
And what do you say about the Phillies, like, in general?
Yeah.
Just that
not unlucky.
the junkiest team in baseball. But it was a really interesting moment for me, because when I watched the StatCast stuff, it was interesting, but felt like a bit of a toy. You know, it felt like something where you could say, well, Jacoby Ellsbury has a 97% route efficiency, and therefore, I don't know, therefore he's efficient when running routes. But this suggests to me that StatCast is creating data sets that's helping us explain the game in ways that we could not before. And that's just about bringing more knowledge into the world, which I think we can all get behind.
Right. There's a difference between trivia and data for its own sake. And sometimes I do think my favorite on that was with the SportView data, where they would tell you in basketball who ran the most miles, or, you know.
In soccer, it's always up there.
Soccer, yeah.
And Michael Bradley's always the one who ran like a half marathon or something.
And yet maybe didn't make the key pass at the key moment.
Yeah, and maybe that tells you even in soccer something about a player's fitness level. In basketball, I just don't know what that actually even tells you or what that means. But and in baseball, I suppose route efficiency, like you had said, Kate, that, you know, not all routes are created equal, and not a straight line is necessarily the best play that you can make. But in something like Rob wrote about, this is actionable, and you can actually see a relationship between this advanced data and a player's performance. And if there's a gap there, it sort of gives you a way to, in the past, you would have to just write off a slump and say, well, you know, I feel like I'm hitting the ball pretty well, but the balls are not falling in, and I just have to ride it out, but I have to take it on faith, and, you know, what's my BABIP, if players were even thinking about that. In the past, certainly they weren't. Now, if you're Utley, you can look at this and say, look, I'm hitting the ball just as well as, you know, one of these other guys that has a lot better stats, and I don't have to take it on faith anymore that this slump will eventually reverse itself or that I've been unlucky. All I have to do is just keep doing what I've been doing. And there's certain kind of weird, it's actionable by not taking action. I think in the past when you're in a slump, maybe you would have changed your stance. So that was something that a lot of players would do, or they felt like they weren't seeing the ball well enough, so they needed to like change something. And by and large, they were actually just attributing to, you know, some kind of mystical slump or the stance was wrong to something that was actually just luck. And so in the case of Utley, the best thing to do is just to not do anything differently, and things will eventually change on their own. And so there's a certain comfort to that, and there's a certain confidence that you can still have even if you're mired in some kind of statistical slump.
One question that I did think about when reading the piece on Chase, we're first name because I lived in Philly and he plays for Philly.
Sure,
so
of course.
It's Chase. Right, so he's hitting the ball well, still, according to the velocity with which the ball is coming.
He's
well,
hitting the ball
average,
better than, yeah.
Better than
you would expect given his
OPS.
Yeah. But at the same time, isn't part of a baseball player's job to also, in some way, hit the ball to gaps? And you, not that you can control precise placement, but the best hitters can see where there are opportunities and be able to like place the ball somewhat. So I guess my question is, even if he's hitting the ball well, but he's not at least being precise in placing the ball where there are openings in the field, don't we need to take that into account? Because also, like, I would think that if you are struggling as a hitter, you're just, if you make contact, it's one level of success. But it's a second level of success to be making contact and also putting the ball in key places. So how are we measuring that?
Right, and this is something where perhaps we even need to have more advanced models to sort of take into account the positioning of the defense and where the angle of the bat face was, you know, pointing when contact was made. there's a parallel here with Corsi, actually, if you think about it, with when it comes to hockey, as we were talking about earlier, which is when you have these statistical things that you sort of write off one aspect of it as luck, and so you have this underlying metric that seems to explain what a player's really doing, and it's somewhat disconnected with the actual point of the game itself, which in hockey it's to score goals. It's not to possess the puck more or put more shots on net, and in the case of baseball, it's to actually get hits when you swing, that there's the potential or the fear that you could game it somehow, and that if once a player learns that he needs to have his Corsi look good while he's on the ice, he's just going to start taking really awful shots at the net as much as possible to game that. And perhaps in baseball, although I think there's less of a deliberateness to, you know, you're just standing up there and you're trying to, you know, react to the pitch and you've got a plan, but there's also a reactionary aspect to it. But theoretically, if you're just trying to game the exit velocity, you would swing as hard as possible and you wouldn't worry about some of the situational things like, you know, going the opposite way with two strikes. And some would argue that that's sort of a lost art in baseball now anyway, with the focus being on power hitting and that strikeouts don't matter as much.
I'm going to selfishly hog the last point on this because then we have to bring Allison in for a significant digit. But I think about this all the time when defenses have shifted against players in baseball now, and whether or not, and what the risk reward is to just poke one the other way into the no man's land on third base versus sacrifice the potential of a double or a home run for a pull hitter or something like that, and sort of whether or not players in that case should be forgetting about their statistics or what could maybe benefit the team long run for what could benefit the team in the here and now. And that seems somewhat related to me, but for another podcast, mm-hmm. We should talk about the shifts at some point. Okay, so let's bring in Allison McCann, one of our visual journalists at 538, who every week brings us our significant digit, a number that tells us some little interesting story about something in sports. Allison, welcome to the show.
Hey, Chad. This week's significant digit is 14 points. I guess also not my significant digit is never a digit, is one thing that I'm finding. Anyway, 14 points is the total number of discipline points that now puts Cesc Fabregas atop of the Premier League, not only winning the Premier League with Chelsea, but now he has the tied for first in the most disciplined player this season. He's got 11 yellow cards and one wonderful red that came yesterday. Not sure if any of you have seen this, but Chelsea was playing West Brom and there was a little scuffle in the penalty box. So the referee stops the play and like runs over to like break up these guys. And meanwhile, Cesc's like on the far right flank, just like with the ball hanging out. And he just said he was innocently going to just chip it over to like where the penalty was and just like nails this West Brom defender in the side of the head. And like the ref thought it was so blatant, like runs over. Anyway, he got a straight red. And now he is in first place for the most disciplined Premier League player this season.
What a title. I sort of wish I was the most disciplined 538 editor or something. That's sort of a badass title.
Do you get time off if you're disciplined?
You get a whole game off if you get the red card, right?
He's facing a 3-game suspension for this. So yeah, he's chipping
a ball into somebody's face.
Yeah.
if a pitcher in baseball got that, that would be like the number of times balls right up into people's faces. Like I was at the Mets game the other day, and Noah Syndergaard, the Mets phenom, just a ball got loose and nailed Carlos Gomez in the face, and Carlos Gomez was left with a ear flap shaped bruise on his face. It was pretty incredible and terrifying to be there. But the point being that this happens all the time in other sports, but the idea here is that Cesc intentionally kicked it?
And it's unclear. His aim was rather perfect, but the play was dead. So it was a very strange red card. And the funniest thing is, like, Chelsea has far and away won the Premier League. This was supposed to be, like, West Brom is, like, in the middle of the pack, like, totally innocent game. And now we have this, like, red card and 3-game ban and, like, loss, and it was just a sort of hilarious sort of ending to the Premier League as we close in on here.
And it seems like Chelsea actually has three of the top six most disciplined players in the
Premier
League.
Neil, so quick with the data work.
In addition to Fabregas, they also have Branislav Ivanovic and Nemanja Matic.
Perfect pronunciation.
Yes, of course, I'm sure. In the top six. So I wonder if there's something of like a Broad Street Bullies type thing going on.
Ooh.
When you talk
Philly
about
reference.
I know, right?
Chippy Chelsea.
When you talk about discipline points, it made me think of other sports where they keep stats on these things, but they're also kind of like sometimes treated like a good thing, like penalty minutes in hockey. In some fantasy leagues, you will actually get credit for having allowing players to accumulate this thing that should be kind of bad. And then at the other side of the coin, there's the Lady Bing trophy in hockey, which is given out to the player who's most gentlemanly, usually a player who's good but has the fewest penalty minutes, and that's looked down on. So I don't know what it says about a sport that that they have something bad that's also considered
and
good.
I love how they're weeding out all the tricks of the trade, right? Because I'm thinking 20 years ago, if you just sort of like kicked a ball inadvertently into somebody, maybe nothing happened. They got, and now they're just weeding all of those out of all sports. I mean, even like if you flop in the NBA now, you can get a technical for that.
You can get the penalized.
You
for,
can get right. It used to just be like, yes. Can you stop doing that? Now you
maybe
can get penalized.
Maybe the guy intentionally took the ball to the face, and Fabregas is just taking the ball
in the way.
That's right. Yeah. Let's penalize him for that.
Right. All right, Allison. Thanks as always for coming in with our Sig Dig of the week.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to you next week. And that, this week, is it for the show. You can email us at contact@538.com. I realize I always forget to tell you listeners that you can reach out to us there. Our producer is Jody Avergan. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. Of course, we're on iTunes as well. You can subscribe to this podcast at itunes.com/538. Even if you are already subscribed, be sure to review and rate the show. It helps others discover the program. We're doing pretty well in the reviews, guys. I'm feeling good about it. Kate, thanks as always for coming in.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil Payne.
Thank you, Chad.
I'm Chad McMatlin. We'll talk to you next time.